administration. During the executive session of the Board of Estimate at which the new contract was scheduled to be approved, Moses was not present. He was presiding at a Long Island ribbon cutting at which Herbert Bayard Swope conferred on him the title of Doctor of Human Betterment. Reporters waiting outside the closed doors heard voices raised in argument for 3.5 hours after Spargo, Leibol, and Brooks went in. Emerging harried, Wagner said the board had refused to okay the contract, and when, in several days, it was resubmitted, Reisner's fee had been cut in half, and Furman's consultantship had been eliminated entirely. Gleason and Cook were not impressed by the fact that Furman was now going to be paid only $300,000 and Reisner only $37,500, particularly after Gleason drew from a perspiring Wagner an admission that he did not know what legal services, if any, Reisner had ever performed for Manhattan Town. This was plain trafficking in huge square-block chunks of city real estate that had been made available to favored insiders at knockdown prices by the taxpayers' millions, Cook wrote. Attempting to put a better face on the arrangement, Wagner then declared with firm and earnest mien that Furman and Milstein will be out as sponsors of Title I projects. They would, he said, never be allowed to benefit from the program in the future. It sounded good, if you didn't think, Cook was to recall, but it seemed to reporters who did that the words, even as the mayor uttered them, had a hollow ring. Weren't Furman and Milstein going to benefit in the future? Of course they were, to the tune of 32%. The developers who hadn't developed were still being rewarded for not developing. They were just not being rewarded as much. And as the various arms of the city government quick-marched through the various steps necessary to the formalization of this arrangement, Gleason and Cook realized that the arrangement was a fait accompli, no matter how diligently they and their fellow journalists alerted the public to its injustices. The total result of their torturously obtained exposés would be to give to the milkers of Manhattan Town a substantial extra helping of pure cream. As for Robert Moses, as the revelations faded away, it became apparent that his powers over slum clearance were to be curtailed not a whit. Their exposés, and the resultant action, had, really, changed nothing. Cook was to write, "It disturbed no fundamental realities. Robert Moses still ran the show. Projects still reeked of political influence." And if anyone had any doubt of the truth of Cook's observation, proof was not long in coming. On the basis of its previous behavior, New York's press could not be expected to take much interest in the relocation details of Lincoln Center, the Title I project that best revealed the vast breadth of Moses' creative, city-shaping imagination. With his first realization of the possibilities in Title I had come what he was later to describe as a vision of a reborn West Side, marching north from Columbus Circle and eventually spreading over the entire dismal and decayed West Side. The Coliseum at the Circle had been the first encampment in that march, and no sooner had he built it than three coincidences had combined to show him the next leg. Sitting beside him on a dozen daises, Fordham President Father Lawrence J. McGinley was repeatedly mentioning to him that the university desperately needed a midtown campus but was unable to afford midtown real estate prices. Ruth Baker Pratt and other opera lovers kept mentioning to him at dinner parties that forcing the Metropolitan Opera to perform in its ancient, inadequate building on 39th Street was scandalous. And then he read in the papers one morning that Carnegie Hall had just formally notified the New York Philharmonic that its lease would not be renewed after 1958. From the three coincidences, his mind leapt to a grand conception. Raising 18 square blocks of slums stretching north from the Colosseum and rearing on their ruins a huge, glittering cultural center that would house, in grandeur, not only university, opera, and philharmonic, but a dozen other related institutions. By 1957, his plan for the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts included not only a four-block square Fordham campus, a Philharmonic Hall, and a new Metropolitan Opera House, but a ballet center, a repertory theater, a high school of the performing arts, a library and museum of the performing arts, a new home for the famed Juilliard School of Music, and such related facilities as 4,400 units of housing, a public school and playground, an underground parking garage, a firehouse, a park with band shell for outdoor concerts, a headquarters for the American Red Cross, and the Fiorello H. LaGuardia High School. Not to speak, as Moses put it, of the neighboring offices of the New York Times. Newspapers were filled with artists' renderings of the magnificent cultural institutions to be erected where, for the most part, shabby tenements now stood. By its traditional standards, the press could not be expected to be very interested in the fact that 7,000 low-income families and 800 businesses were going to have to be displaced from the site, or in the charges being made that despite the fact that, as reformer I.D. Robbins put it, there are plenty of funds available under various housing acts to enable the planner to establish the first truly balanced neighborhood in New York, Moses was not making even a pretense of creating new homes for the families displaced. To replace the 7,000 low-income apartments being destroyed, 4,400 new ones were being planned, 4,000 of them luxury apartments. By its traditional standards, however, the press might be expected to be interested in several financial facts about Lincoln Center. Although Moses had received an offer from certain reputable housing developers of $9.58 per square foot for land, he was selling the land to other, favored developers for $7 per square foot. While the city was acquiring the rest of the huge site by blanket condemnation proceedings, it had for some unexplained reason found it advisable to take the building at 70 Columbus Avenue, owned, under a trust established by Democratic money man and Charles Buckley intimate Joseph P. Kennedy, by Robert F. Kennedy and three of his sisters, Jean Kennedy Smith, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, and Patricia Kennedy Lawford, not by condemnation, but by purchase, for $2,500,000. A price so high that while the land under the buildings adjacent to the one owned by the Kennedys was worth $9.58 per square foot, the land under theirs became worth $62.88 per square foot. And those facts were to be brought to the press's attention by public statements by a public official. For Housing and Home Finance Agency Administrator Albert M. Cole, overall federal administrator of Title I, who had been chafing for years over Moses' administration of Title I in New York, Lincoln Center was the last straw. In April, Cole had attempted to go over Moses' head, refusing to provide funds for the giant cultural complex until the city's mayor and board of estimate met with him to decide broad policy questions about Title I's future in New York. Wagner let him know who would decide that future. "Would suggest your representatives meet with Slum Clearance Committee," the mayor telegrammed. The press had backed Moses, and Cole had been forced to back down. Now, with the Manhattan Town mess spread on the record, Cole, believing that some of the glitter might have rubbed off the Moses legend, and that the time might be ripe to curtail his powers, decided to try again. He demanded new appraisals of the Lincoln Center real estate by independent appraisers. And when Moses refused, Cole charged publicly that during the HHFA's 10-year existence, the agency has had more trouble with Mr. Robert Moses than with any other single individual in all the cities of the United States. Title I's many difficulties in New York, he stated, were due to Moses' unique method for selecting housing sponsors and his refusal to consider changing it. It has been our documented and arduous experience that Mr. Moses misrepresents what the housing agency is doing or trying to do. He will not take the trouble to ascertain the facts. His obscurities are misleading, and he is inflexibly bent on following his own course, whatever may be the outcome. Threatening to cut off all Title I aid to the city unless the method was changed, Cole again asked Wagner and the board to intercede. Moses' response was his usual offer to resign. Any further statements on this subject will, of course, have to come from the mayor, he said. Wagner could not make his statement fast enough. Within an hour after Moses offered to resign, the mayor rejected it. In a late-afternoon press release, which contained a political version of a Freudian slip as to his reasoning. I have every confidence in Bob Moses. Mr. Moses has made great contributions to the city of New York, and the people are well aware of this. And proof of the political wisdom of the mayor's course arrived with the morning papers, so much more important to a politician than the PM's. Wagner, by rushing, had just barely beaten them to the punch. Said the Herald Tribune, true enough, the course of Title I slum clearance has been far from smooth, but such deficiencies ought to be a challenge to renewed effort at getting things done. New York has been committed from the beginning to the Bob Moses way of getting things done. Washington should take notice that this city will not drop its construction pilot. The New York Times responded to Cole's challenge with perhaps its clearest statement ever of its principal owner's feelings about Robert Moses. Mr. Cole had better face the fact, as FDR had to, that New York City is not going to drop Bob Moses as a public servant as long as he is willing to keep working for the city. LaGuardia, O'Dwyer, Impellitteri, Wagner, none of them as mayor could get along without him. To be sure, it's possible to find a mistake and a failure here and there. But look at the long, long record of successes. You don't bench a Babe Ruth because he strikes out once in a while. You consider the home runs and the batting average. Maybe some other system would have worked better here, on urban renewal, than the unique New York system. That can only be a matter of speculation. What we do know is that, in general, New York's slum clearance progress has been unequaled, and that, in the memory of living men on the New York scene, there has never been the equal of Bob Moses for getting things done. The federal government is not going to change Mr. Moses. It had better try to get along with him, for that is the way we will travel farthest, fastest, for the public good. Moses could push a button and the calls would pour in, Lutsky says. Calls from the people who really mattered. Now Moses pushed that button. People in New York who had access directly to the White House used that access. Father McGinley and other key figures in the Catholic Archdiocese, key union leaders, key bankers, John D. Rockefeller III himself, all were on the phone to Washington. The amount of pressure he put on was just unbelievable, Cole says. He just murdered me in there. A compromise was hastily announced. The HHFA would accept a new appraisal by Moses' own appraisers, the same men who had made the original appraisals. Meanwhile, the HHFA was reserving for Lincoln Center the $27 million for which Moses had asked. It was a striking display of power. After the Lincoln Center episode, Gleason and Cook realized bitterly that Moses still had too much power to be touched by the federal government, just as he had too much power to be touched by the city government. Even more bitter was their realization that, despite their attempts to shatter his image, it still endured, looming over New York almost as brightly as ever. Part of the Moses myth, the part that portrayed the park commissioner as the park defender, had been cracked away by the Battle of Central Park. But the heart of the myth, the part that portrayed Moses as a man above politics and corruption, had not. 30 years, and thousands upon thousands of newspaper articles, had gone into the creation of that myth. No single series of exposés in a single newspaper was going to destroy it, particularly not when that series, while revealing corruption in a Moses-run program, shied away from connecting that corruption with Moses personally. Gleason and Cook had hoped that other papers would pick up their revelations, repeat them, launch full-scale investigations of their own. Instead, when it came to the crunch, editorials had likened Robert Moses not to Boss Tweed, but to Babe Ruth. Gleason and Cook knew that reporters on every paper in town wanted to dig into the Moses empire. They knew, therefore, that the decision not to dig and to support Moses against the federal government had been made at higher levels. Gleason and Cook could see that Moses' relationship with publishers and top editors was as close as ever. Not only had they been the recipients of his charm and his favors, they had been the key figures in making the Moses myth. They had a psychological vested interest in it. To dispatch investigators to dig into it would be an admission on their part that they had been wrong for years. That was not an admission that, in the absence of evidence a lot stronger than Gleason had been able to uncover, they were prepared to make. Some of them would permit their papers to print derogatory items about Moses if such items were breaking news. They would not allow their reporters to dig up such items and make them news. And without such digging beneath the surface of that image, the image would endure. They may have chipped it, they realized, but it was still there. Still, they kept working, despite new obstacles. The heat was really on, Cook says. City officials, with whom we had been able to talk previously, flew into rages at the sight of us, and later let us know privately that they had had to put on an act either because spies had been planted at their elbows or because they felt their offices were bugged, their phones tapped. The reporting half of this team sometimes found strange men trailing after him when he made his rounds of the municipal offices. And the little guys in the scandal-packed bureaus, the men who had fed us with tips, asked us never to try to get in touch with them again, even at their homes at midnight. They all felt that their phones were tapped, that they were being watched. They were working almost alone. There was a time, and it lasted for almost 3 years, when we were virtually the only writers in New York focusing a critical spotlight on the Title I program, Cook was to write. And while he may have exaggerated the length of time involved, the rest of his statement was accurate. Only strip mining before, Gleason was digging deep now, his way lighted by a long line of anonymous tips, and he was beginning to unearth evidence that the city's whole political structure was tied into Title I. Photostats of canceled checks for Manhattan Town's insurance premiums were placed in his hands, and Cook was thereupon able to write, "Manhattan Town began with Sam Caspert in a political clubhouse. Caspert was a vice president of Robert Blakey's Democratic Club on the Upper West Side. Blakey handled the insurance. Many of the original investors, officers, and employees of Manhattan Town came out of Blakey's political club. Residents of Gramercy Park protested that their neighborhood wasn't a slum. They couldn't understand why it had been designated for slum clearance. Gleason and Cook informed them that their own assemblyman, who in public was opposing the project, was in private the organizer of the real estate syndicate to whom Moses had awarded it, the revelation marking the first time that an elected public official had been closely identified with Title I operations. And each tip about politics and corruption established more clearly the link between them and the living legend who was supposedly above them. By March 1958, the circle had tightened to a point at which Gleason and Cook were able to print that Moses' man, William S. Liebhol, the director of Moses' Slum Clearance Committee, was a stockholder in the Nassau Management Company, a real estate firm that had been set up on a shoestring just 3 years before, and that during those 3 years it had collected, largely for tenant relocation on Moses' slum clearance and highway projects, fees totaling $2,250,000. They were able to print that a brochure published by the firm to lure potential investors into purchasing its stock contained endorsements not only by Liebhol, but by two other Moses men, Slum Clearance Committee Assistant Director Samuel Brooks and Housing Authority Chairman Philip J. Cruz. And they were even able to reveal the ties between this corporate recipient of Moses' largesse and Tammany Hall. The firm was so generous a contributor to the hall that its president had been invited by the Democratic State Committee to serve as vice chairman of the annual party dinner. All relocation contracts had been funneled through the City Real Estate Bureau, and that bureau was headed by a boutonniered frontman for Carmine DeSapio, Percy Gale, Jr., and the two reporters acquired and printed evidence of an even closer link between the man supposedly above politics and the archetypal politician. DeSapio Representative Gale was a member of Moses' slum clearance committee. But Gleason and Cook were the only reporters investigating Title I now. The Post faithfully reported the controversy, mostly tenant protests, over the various Title I sites, but was doing no original investigative work of its own. Gleason and Cook needed the prestigious AMs. Having recanted their apostasy, however, these papers were showing no inclination whatsoever to repeat it. "All through this time," Cook says, "we were shooting our shots practically alone." Enthusiasm for their work was not exactly rampant even on their own city desk. The editors, unenthusiastic about making the World Telegram a voice of dissent amid a chorus of praise, kept downplaying Moses' connection with the revelations of political influence, the connection that had to be made, clearly and strongly, if the public was, amid the complexities of Title I, to grasp it. In the Gleason-Cook article revealing that the Gramercy Park slum clearance project had been given to an assemblyman, for example, there was not a mention of who had given the assemblyman the project. Moses' name never appeared. Cook's paragraphs making what the rewrite man considered the key point of the Nassau management scandals, that a Robert Moses aide had received immensely lucrative contracts from Robert Moses without competitive bidding, were edited out of his copy day after day. Liebel and Brooks were identified as city officials, although what they really were Moses officials. The contracts involved in the stories were described as city contracts, although not the city, but Moses had awarded them. "The guts were cut out of those stories," Cook says. Moreover, as Cook puts it, "the paper began to get more and more weary of this. There was no real pressure from publisher Howard. It was just, who the hell understands this stuff? It's too goddamn complicated for the public to understand. The public doesn't care." In essence, it was, "when are you guys going to start doing something else?" I'd write a great story, and I'd come in the next day, and it'd be on page 27. The myth that surrounded Moses had been created on page 1. It was on page 1 that the myth would have to be destroyed. Stories on page 27 would never do it. Knowing this as they did, the 2 years following the Manhattan Town Exposé was a time of terrible frustration for Gene Gleason and Fred Cook. Moses' manipulations may have been on page 27. His triumphs were on page 1. Despite revelations that would have destroyed the career of the typical public official, during these 2 years, this public official rammed through, over the opposition of protesting neighborhoods, approval for new expressways, for 2 great new bridges, the Throgs Neck and the Verrazano, together with the neighborhood-destroying bridge approach routes he wanted. Killed, over the efforts of Brooklyn Dodgers owner Walter O'Malley, plans for a city sports authority that might have kept the Dodgers and Giants in New York, and began happily to plan the housing projects that he had wanted on the sites of the Polo Grounds and Ebbets Field all along. Presided with a grim smile of triumph at ribbon cuttings marking the opening of the Harlem River Drive and a dozen other public works projects, and sat in his limousine laughing at protesters burning him in effigy. It was during these years, in fact, that there were named after him 2 dams, 2 parkways, 2 parks, and a bridge. While those 2 gutter snipes had been trying to blacken his name, it had, instead, been enshrined forever, in concrete and steel and imperishable pieces of the public domain. "You know, once you get headlines, you get people coming to you," Cook says. "But when the paper itself begins to lose interest, doesn't play these things, the well sort of dries up, you know?" It was drying up now. There were fewer and fewer tips. And Gleason and Cook were finding it harder and harder to check into what tips there were. The desk was just tired and bored with it, and it wasn't making a public impact. The paper couldn't afford this investment in time indefinitely. Other things had come up that they'd want us on. They couldn't spare us for Title I anymore. By the time 1959 came around, the early winter of 59, We were pretty much dead. To understand what Gleason and Cook did then, it is necessary to understand Gleason and Cook. Gleason was front page, big, brawny, and boisterous, with a crooked Irish grin and a nose that must have been broken at least once in his 32 years. He looked the part, complete to the collar of his trench coat, which was invariably turned up. And he acted it. Hard drinking, he talked loudly in bar rooms about the big stories he was working on, the big men he was going to unmask. The sacred profession of journalism was to him the newspaper game, and he played it with a swagger. Cook could always tell when Gleason had dug up a good item. He'd be licking his chops. He'd come in with a bounce and a grin and turn down the aisle and, "Hey, we got a good one today." But Gene Gleason was driven by more than an urge for self-dramatization. Injustice, the little guy being trampled on by powers too big for him to fight, those were the stories that interested him. And in trying to pin them down and get them into print, as fellow World Telegram staffer John Ferris wrote, "Nothing halts him. Time is of no consequence. He will work 24 hours without thought of rest. Weather never daunts him. He has sloshed through rain, crawled through snow, braved bitter cold, and sweated through oppressive heat. He is tough physically and tough mentally." Covering a revolt by Transit Authority motormen against powerful TA union boss Mike Quill, he sensed that the motormen's headquarters was being bugged and warned them. Following his advice, they found a hidden microphone from which a wire led out the window. Police summoned to the scene were conspicuously uninterested in discovering where the wire led. Gleason climbed out the window into a freezing, windy winter night to follow it over treacherous, ice-covered roofs himself. The ice forced him to give up that night, but the next day, when no one expected him, he was back, found policemen rolling up the wire, and uncovered the fact that the Transit Authority had planted the bug with apparent police connivance. Wrote Ferris, "No one awes him. The story comes first." And when he couldn't get that story, when he had to watch injustice and do nothing about it, Gene Gleason took it personally. Wrote Murray Kempton, "He seemed to me out of another time, and I must confess that with him I was never sorry that I was so middle-aged. If I took things the way Gene Gleason did, I wouldn't sleep at night. He is a big fellow and a young one, but when I first met him, the first thing I thought was here is a man who doesn't sleep at night." Fred J. Cook kept his coat collars flat and his voice low. He was not a reporter, but a rewrite man, the quintessential rewrite man, so accustomed to seeing the world through the earpiece of a telephone headset and notes taken by other men that he felt no need to see it for himself. Not once during the more than 3 years during which he was writing about Manhattan Town did he get into a subway to take the 20-minute ride that would have enabled him to see Manhattan Town. He never once visited the site of that development. "I was tied to the desk all the time, one story after another. The grind in there was such that at the end of the day I just wanted to get out of there." But he had the gift of turning notes into prose. During the 15 years he had sat at a desk in the World Telegram's rewrite bank, in 1959 he was 48, Fred Cook had earned a reputation as a fast man with a good word. "Fred Cook was a master writer," Joe Kahn says. No reporter who saw Manhattan Town described it nearly as well as Cook did without seeing it. And you could be quiet and tied to a desk and still care. During the 1950s, few journalists, even the most liberal, criticized the FBI. In a brilliant article for The Nation, Cook criticized the FBI. At the very height of the storm of invective against Alger Hiss, Cook wrote a book defending Alger Hiss. And by 1959, Cook had gotten to care quite deeply about Title I. Years later, questioned about his reasons for pursuing a story his editors would have been happy to see him drop, Cook, speaking in a low, calm voice, would tick off reasons founded in intellect, that he felt he had failed to make the public understand the importance of the issues involved, that other newspapers had failed in their responsibility by refusing to pick up their stories, that we were sure there was a bigger scandal there, and we hated to see it die without further effort being made on the thing. You mean there was no feeling of injustice involved on your part? An interviewer would ask. Yeah, Cook said, his voice betraying surprise that the other man should not have understood that. I used to get these phone calls. I remember there was this druggist. He had a little store in the Washington Square area for 25 years, and all they were offering him was $750 for his fixtures, and he had just paid $15,000 for them. And when he tried to get to see someone about them, they wouldn't even listen to him. There were dozens of calls like that. Dozens. They were too small fry for anyone to listen to them. I had this deep sense of injustice. I felt I knew Moses. The son of a bitch doesn't give a good goddamn about people, and he never did. The power brokers only care about power, and who the hell the little human beings are who get trampled in their game doesn't mean a hoot in hell to them. The measure of Cook's caring was the series he had been writing. The telly had a real skeleton staff compared to the Times or the Trib, he would recall. There were never enough guys on the rewrite bank, so you were always writing too much every day anyway. There were always other stories to do, breaking stories. They never wanted to give me any time for these, so I had to just keep them going myself, as a side effort, so to speak. Gleason and Cook possessed a full share of journalistic competitiveness. They had won awards for their stories, the exclusives they had dug up or written themselves, and they wanted more awards, and therefore more exclusives. Their paper, hitting the newsstands each afternoon within minutes of the Post and Journal American, was part of a fierce three-way competition. But now, frustrated, knowing that, unless they did something drastic, we were dead, as far as further exposures of Title I and Robert Moses were concerned, Gleason and Cook decided that the only way to keep it going was to share their hard-dug material, to give it to a competitor. The choice of whom to give it to was an obvious one. Only the Post would give Gleason's information the play it deserved and invest the time and energy necessary to dig out its own. And there was a Post reporter, 31-year-old William J. Haddad, who had already proven, in sensational exposés of city building department malpractice, that he possessed all Gleason's toughness and tenacity, in addition to the rare ability to discern patterns in seemingly unrelated facts, to identify the locus, not just the symptoms, of corruption. Luckily, Haddad and Gleason were already friends. Gleason gave him information, and Haddad was soon writing stories based on it. The Post's stories had the effect on Gleason's city desk that he had known it would. His editors got interested in Title I again, even more so because Gleason was able to provide them with new leads, given him by Haddad. For Haddad quickly arrived at the same realization as Cook and Gleason. We found out very early that it had to be a joint effort, he says. It would never go. It would rise and die in one paper unless another paper picked it up. Then the TV would pick it up, and then the political authorities would start to react. That was the carbohydrate that made it work. Soon, like two flamenco dancers spurring each other to wilder and wilder efforts, Haddad and Gleason were both helping and striving to outdo each other, their stories picking up and taking off from each other's and hitting harder and harder. As the tempo accelerated, moreover, the tipsters joined in again, a whole chorus of disgruntled bureaucrats who realized that this time there was a real chance that someone would print their information. With its two competitors playing a scandal in banner headlines day after day, the third afternoon daily couldn't ignore it, even if its top executives would have liked to. Soon, the Journal American was printing Title I stories. Then, tentatively at first, then more and more boldly, readers were given a chance to read about Title I in the morning as well. The Trib was in. But the pooling continued. In fact, there soon sprang up a circle at whose heart were Haddad and Gleason, but which included also Woody Klein of the Telly, the Journal American's Marty Stedman, Peter Braestrup of the Herald Tribune, and a reporter from the Underground, 31-year-old Mary Perot Nichols. Born a Philadelphia mainline WASP, she had moved to the East Village, begun crusading against Moses' proposed road through Washington Square Park, and had seen at a glance truths about Moses' whole method of operation that no one, seemingly, had understood before. Her only journalistic connection was the Village Voice, but her observations in it were in many ways the most penetrating printed up to that time. These reporters would meet almost daily with Hortense Gable, the one city official willing to openly help them. There was no one important at that table. "We were chipmunks," Hortense Gable would recall. "Moses wouldn't even know who we were. There was no one important even in journalism." But they met daily, an underground movement to force the city's journalistic establishment to do what they wanted. In any assessment of their motivations, their age is important. Everyone in the circle was in his late 20s or early 30s. Recalling those days, years later, Haddad would say with a rueful smile, "Our motives? It was us against the world, us against them, the city, corruption, unmovable forces. We were young enough to breathe that kind of air then." Moreover, these young idealists hadn't even been born when Robert Moses had been on the front pages battling the robber barons to open Long Island to the masses. They had been only infants when Jones Beach was dedicated. In 1934, when Robert Moses had revitalized New York City's park system to the city's cheers, Gleason had been only 7 years old, Haddad 6. The Robert Moses they knew was not the Robert Moses of the beautiful parks and the beautiful parkways, the parkways that were going to solve traffic problems. The Robert Moses they knew was the Robert Moses of the Tavern on the Green and Manhattan Town and those damned expressways he insisted on building, even though everybody knew the city should be building subways instead, and for which he evicted thousands of helpless families. Their impression of him was of an arrogant, dictatorial old man who, if not corrupt himself, had certainly managed to surround himself with a lot of corrupt people. Like the Newmans, they were too young to have seen him as great. They saw him only as crotchety, old, and wrong. Their perception of the coordinator was unclouded by the preconceptions that had clouded reporters' eyes in the 20s and 30s, that he was the selfless, incorruptible, apolitical public servant sans peur et sans reproche. They saw him as who he was. The members of this journalistic cabal were also too young to be afraid. Those rare reporters of the 30s and 40s who might have contemplated investigating the Moses Empire had been very conscious of what had happened to reporters who had tried it before. But it had been a long time now since Robert Moses had broken a reporter, so long that Haddad and Gleason didn't even know that he ever had. Haddad, the spiritual heir of Milton McCusin, a Herald Tribune reporter who a decade earlier had investigated the Moses Empire and written a series on it, but had seen the series killed and had been forced to personally apologize to Moses to boot, had never even heard McCusin's name, much less the story of how his career had been wrecked. If the age explanation was simple, the psychological was not. The motives that inspired these young reporters to take on the most powerful SOB in the city were as mixed as are the motives of all investigative reporters. One cannot talk to some of them for long without knowing that competitiveness was a spur, and in varying degrees there was present also at that table the desire for personal self-glorification, as well as the simple desire to drag down someone bigger than they. But, with most of them at least, so was a spur of a purer metal.
"Can't somebody do something about the son of a bitch?"
Gleason had shouted to Cook in frustration one day, and behind that shout was the outrage, the sense of injustice that had built up in him and in his partner over what Moses and the city's other power brokers were doing to the little human beings who get trampled in their game. "To me," Kahn says, "he was the personification of a certain arrogance against the average man. I don't think he ever cared about how many hearts he had to break to get things done. And so I felt he had to be stopped, and there wasn't anyone else to stop him but us. If most young men of intelligence and drive are ambitious, not all of them put that intelligence and drive at the service of justice, as had a Jean Gleason or a Bill Haddad. And they kept chipping away at the image of Robert Moses. After 30 years of building up that image, the press had begun chopping it down. It was triumph as usual for Moses as 1959 opened. Having celebrated his 70th birthday on a Christmas vacation in Barbados, he was greeted upon his return after New Year's by reporters trooping into his office to commemorate the occasion with interviews and stories reporting, as stories had reported on his 60th birthday and his 65th, that time had left no visible mark upon the man who, the Long Island press reiterated in 48-point Bodoni, was still public friend number one. And by news that the success of the largest bond issue in history had been assured by a syndicate of the biggest investment bankers on Wall Street, and that the $750 million that would bring his Niagara dream to fruition was therefore in hand. The submission of his reappointment as State Power Authority chairman touched off anger in the state Senate chamber. "He has held every public official who has ever disagreed with him up to ridicule and scorn," one senator said. "I don't call that greatness, but a desire to do away with the democratic processes." Another said he had never encountered an arrogance that could even approach that of the man we are asked to approve. But the lopsidedness of the margin by which the nomination was approved after such denunciation, 50-6, with several of the senators who had joined in the denunciation casting their votes for confirmation, was proof that his power in Albany was as great as ever. And when, shortly after his return, he announced a series of huge new Title I projects, the announcements were greeted by the press with customary uncritical acclaim. All was as it had always been. But by the beginning of February, Haddad was poking holes in those announcements. Only 20 families out of 1,420 now living on the site of the Title I Gramercy Park slum clearance project will be able to afford the rents for the new housing units. And by the middle of February, Haddad had one of his own to make. It had a hard-hitting lead. Sidney J. Unger is a man of position and property. His property, a post-investigation revealed today, includes some of the city's worst slums. And a hard-hitting headline, "The Slum Properties of an Anti-Slum Leader," and plenty of facts to back them up. Unger, Moses' choice for sponsor of the Riverside Amsterdam Urban Renewal Project, had indignantly and volubly denied the tip Haddad had gotten that he was a slumlord. "As a native New Yorker whose entire life has been devoted to the welfare of the people of the city, assuming leadership in philanthropic, religious, and communal activities, I have for many years been fighting the real battle for improvement of housing," said his press release. He had threatened to sue for several $1 million if the Post said different. If Haddad didn't believe him, he said, the reporter could just go and look at his buildings. But Haddad had done what Unger had evidently not expected him to do. He went and looked. The quotes from Unger's tenants: "My son Stephen, he's 6, is in the hospital. A rat bit him between the eyes. I tried to fix the rat holes here, but the rats cut right through. I complained, but no one did anything to fix them. I have no water, hot or cold. The bathroom ceiling is falling down. Rats all over the building. Sewers backing up. Dumbwaiter packed with garbage. Cellar flooded. Made great copy, and the pictures that confirmed the quotes made great pictures. And the fact that Robert Moses was giving a lucrative slum clearance project to a slumlord, and a politically well-connected slumlord at that, Haddad discovered and printed Unger's financial backing of campaigns of both Wagner and Hewlin Jack, made a great story, and the Post not only played it to the hilt, but emphasized that it was a Post exclusive. And after that story had appeared, the World Telegram's editors, afraid of falling behind in a story that had once been exclusively theirs, hastily reassigned Gleason to Title I, and he began coming up with revelations of his own. And soon the Post was picking up the Telly's stories and the Telly's the Post's. And the editors of each paper, afraid that when the rival paper hit the stand that afternoon they would find themselves outplayed, were playing these revelations as editors had so seldom played revelations about Robert Moses' mistakes. Big. And just in case their interest might slacken, Haddad and Gleason, while ostensibly, for the benefit of their bosses, fiercely competing for new exclusives, were actually dividing them up, one and one. And by March, Joe Kahn was on the story too, and Kahn was writing it as it should be written. In his leads, for the first time consistently in any paper, it was no longer the Mayor's Slum Clearance Committee, but Robert Moses' Slum Clearance Committee. Anxiously leafing through the paper every day to see where his latest story had been played, Haddad no longer had to leaf far. It was a rare day on which the latest Title I exposé was not the lead on page 7 or 5 or 3. Day by day, the reporter watched Title I march off the inside pages of the Telly and the Journal and the Trib and onto the split pages and then onto page 1. For generations, people thrown out of their homes by Robert Moses had been complaining about his ruthlessness. Now, at last, their complaints were in headlines. Nowhere to go and 30 days to get there. To get us out, they move very quickly. In 1953, the Women's City Club had issued reports disclosing that Moses had been shifting tenants in slum clearance sites to other buildings on the site like gypsies. The reports had been ignored. In 1954, a minority report of the City Planning Commission had made similar revelations. That report had been ignored. But now, in 1959, when J. Clarence Davies Jr., new independent head of the city's real estate bureau, made the same report, it was, "City admits shifts from slums to slums." "The press of the city, awake at last," Fred Cook exulted. And he was right. The press had not been awakened by its owners, with the exception of Mrs. Schiff, of course, or by its top editors, with the exception of the Post's James Weschler, of course. It had been awakened by its reporters, not by its famous reporters, but by young, unknown staff writers scheming together to force publishers and editors to do what the young men felt was their duty. But it was awake. And then came an issue that required no repertorial scheming to become a big story, for it was too much of a natural, as much a natural as the Tavern on the Green fight that had begun the deflation of the Moses image. This story had the same key setting as that fight. Its locale was, in fact, just a short stroll away, the sacred turf of Central Park. Some headline writers were, in fact, to dub it the Second Battle of Central Park. It had issues as simple and clear-cut, black and white, starkly dramatic. And if it did not have mothers and baby carriages, it had something almost as good. W. Shakespeare. Chapter 44. Mustache and the Bard. Mr. Mulder, in connection with the work that you were doing at the present time, do you have the opportunity to inject into your plays, or into the acting or the entertainment supervision which you have, any propaganda in any way which would influence others to be sympathetic with the communist philosophy or the beliefs of communism? Mr. Papirovsky. Sir, the plays we do are Shakespeare's plays. Shakespeare said, "To thine own self be true," and various other lines from Shakespeare can hardly be said to be subversive or influencing minds. I cannot control the writings of Shakespeare. Mr. Ahrens, we are not concerned with the plays, and you know we are not, and there is no suggestion here by this chairman or anyone else that Shakespeare was a communist. That is ludicrous and absurd. That is the commie line. Hearings of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, June 19, 1958, Testimony of Joseph Papirovsky, PAP. What press and public were never told about the Second Battle of Central Park, and because of the viciousness of the tactics Moses employed in his campaign to win it, would probably not have believed if they had been told, was that he did not want it, and had no part in bringing it about. Of all the battles the old lion had fought, this was the one for which he had least stomach. Robert Moses loved Shakespeare. He could recite whole scenes, and he loved the idea of presenting Shakespeare in Central Park. He had never met Joseph Papp, but he liked his style. When, in 1956, the boyish-looking CBS stage manager had asked for permission to present free productions of Shakespeare in the little amphitheater Moses had built in 1936 at Corlear's Hook on the waterfront on the Lower East Side, Moses had asked around about him and had been impressed with what he was told. Slight, dark-haired Joe Papirovsky had grown up in Brooklyn's brawling Williamsburg, surrounded by terror, I got beat up regularly, and by poverty. To help his trunk-maker father pay the rent, he hauled garbage, hawked newspapers, sold pretzels, plucked chicken feathers, and shined shoes. I thought I'd never get the black out of my fingers. His mother stuffed cardboard in the soles of his own. Then, at the age of 12, he discovered the public library and Shakespeare, memorizing vast tracts of the plays. In the Navy during the war, he produced shows on the decks of aircraft carriers. Mustered out, he used the GI Bill to attend not college, but the Actors' Laboratory. While working in 1953 as a television stage manager, CBS-TV changed his name because Papirovsky was inconveniently long for the credits, he finally implemented an idea he had cherished for years. His life had been changed by books, free books, the only kind he could afford. Poor people were as entitled to free theater as free books. Begging pittances from foundations to rent the basement of a church on the Lower East Side and pay the salaries of promising young actors, he began to put on Shakespearean plays, productions that, critics began to notice, were not only free, but good. Moses had been suspicious that Papp might be trying to use the amphitheater as a money-making device, but from all reports, Papp was genuine. When theater critic Walter Kerr advised him to charge admission because people appreciate more what they pay for, he had replied that, "If I had had to pay, it is doubtful that I would have read the plays of Shakespeare." Adding that it was because people had to pay for theater tickets that most New Yorkers had never seen a live professional production. "I believe," he said, "that it is of the utmost importance to have a public theater, a theater for everybody, yes, everybody, for those who can afford it and those who cannot." Moses would ordinarily have agreed with Kerr, but he had built the amphitheater because Al Smith had told him that, as a youth on the Lower East Side, anxious to become an actor, he could never afford a theater ticket, and in the intervening 20 years, no one had ever evinced the slightest interest in producing plays in it. No one, in fact, had ever evinced much interest in producing anything in it. The amphitheater generally stood empty and unused. Papp's proposal would put the structure at last to use, the use for which Moses had intended it. When Park Department Executive Officer Stuart Constable argued that poor people wouldn't appreciate Shakespeare and that the tough kids in the neighborhood would break up the show, Moses told Mustache, "Oh, let him have it." It was, in fact, Moses who gave Papp his first big boost. The big foundations would not consider even modest grants without an expression of interest from the Park Commissioner. Papp wrote the commissioner asking for one and got it. During that first season in that little amphitheater on the East River, two things had become apparent. One, the moment the lights went up and the spectators saw the facades of an Italian Renaissance town, and, through an ingenious series of arches and doorways, an entire cast made an entrance in full regalia, and from the audience came a single, thrilled, breathless, "Ah!" The other, when the reviews came in. One, Papp was right. The city's poor would appreciate Shakespeare. Two, Papp's productions were good, considering the youth of his actors and the paucity of his budget, amazingly good. Moses liked audacity, and, as the more perceptive of his aides had previously noticed, this man who had never had the son he so badly wanted often revealed a certain tenderness toward audacious young men. When, the following year, Pap had shown up at the arsenal with a plan to bring the bard to the whole city via a mobile stage that would be transported from park to park on a truck scrounged from a boyhood chum, Moses' reaction to Constable's doubts had been a gruff, "Oh, let him do it." He had placed at Pap's disposal park department equipment and employees, a car and chauffeur. And when, in 1957, Pap had asked to present plays in Central Park, Moses had said okay, as long as he didn't charge admission and try to make money out of his shows. If the commissioner had doubts as to the wisdom of his decision, the reviews for the first Central Park season must have come down heavily on Pap's side. While holding down a full-time job as CBS stage manager, he had managed to produce, on a shoestring so frayed that he was sometimes opening productions without money on hand to pay for more than two performances, a gamble that always seemed to pay off in sufficient contributions for a full run, productions that were hailed as not just good, but great. Pap's Central Park Romeo and Juliet, Kerr said, was, in many respects, the best Romeo and Juliet I have ever seen. Pap was continually asking Moses to allow him to solicit voluntary contributions from the stage. Moses, through Constable, was continually refusing. Pap was continually making the solicitation anyway. Before one performance, a police sergeant told Pap, in a friendly way, "If you go on tonight, I'll have to pull you in." "Well then, we'll go out on the street, Central Park West," Pap said. "That's park department property too," the sergeant said. "Across the street?" Pap asked. "And," the producer recalls, "he said that was all park department property too, except the northwest corner." So Pap stationed men on that corner with big baskets. Watching Moses carefully to gauge the depth of his outrage at this defiance, Sid Shapiro was astonished to see a grin of delight sneak across RM's face. The park commissioner always politely refused Pap's invitations to attend. What was he supposed to do, sit on a blanket? But he had had himself driven past the scene and had been pleased with the spectators' orderliness. He had been very pleased with published reaction to the plays. After 2 years, New York was having a love affair with its Shakespeare Festival. A queue began to form 3 hours before the distribution of tickets began at 6:15 each evening. For every performance, it seemed, the lawn was filled. Hundreds of standees crowded up to the fences in the back, and hundreds of other persons had to be turned away from what Horizon magazine called "this blessed plot, this Shakespeare in the park." Observers noted that, as Horizon put it, drawn from all classes and income groups, the Central Park spectators have an almost Elizabethan buoyancy and verve which are a startling contrast to the spiritual vacuity of Broadway's mink matrons and expense account aristocrats. They come not out of duty, but out of desire. And the spectators included people whose opinions Moses listened to. Theatrical people like his neighbor Cornelia Otis Skinner and Port Authority Chairman Howard S. Coleman were telling him excitedly about the brilliance of the productions and of the unknown young actors and actresses whom Pap was discovering and persuading to work for $40 a week. Coleman was particularly impressed by a young fellow who had gotten his first big role in Pap's production of The Merchant of Venice, George C. Scott. Moses' favorite magazine, Saturday Review, pointed out that, because the festival performance drew 2,100 persons into the park each evening, a whole section of Central Park was transformed from a threatening jungle into a tranquil gathering place for healthy entertainment. At a party thrown for Pap and his cast by the Tavern on the Green, Schleifer had gotten quite a business out of it, Pap notes. Constable came over to me and said, "Don't worry about next season. I talked to Mr. Moses about it, and he's going to raise the money himself." And Moses fully intended to do so. Shortly thereafter, Pap received a letter from the commissioner, whom he had never met, saying that he had already contacted Coleman about forming a committee to raise the $50,000 needed for another season, and that Papp could stop worrying. In March 1959, when Moses left for a three-week Barbados vacation, the producer believed that everything was set. Papp and Constable had never gotten along well.